Fancast to start the week, Drancer, after a weekend that saw the Canucks show up in the new unis, but same old results. A 2-0 shutout loss to Winnipeg on Friday, and they followed it up by playing well enough for a while, but in the end, followed a similar script. They fall 4-3 in overtime. Pierre-Luc Dubois, the winner. So let's just start with some simple math, because on the last Fancast, you had basically laid it out. You know, two against the Jets, two against the Oilers, two more against Winnipeg, a six-game stretch, and you suggested the Canucks needed to win five of them. So I have racked my brain here through the night after the overtime loss, and I'm trying to figure out a way that the Canucks can win five of the next four.
Yeah, they can't, unfortunately. And you know, look, this is where you get to when you're not very good. Right? Like, this is where you get to when you're not very good. The Canucks start playing really well 2 weeks ago. They have that crucial practice against Toronto. They've been completely embarrassed over four games against the Habs and the Maple Leafs. And they find something, right? They drop their F3 lower in the zone. For some reason, that seems to activate a ton of what they're doing 5-on-5. And this team starts to play well. They start to control play. They start to play like a team that, if they played like that all year, would legitimately be in the fight. But they didn't. Like, they just didn't. And that has left them with no margin for error. So over the last eight games, or over the last seven games, this team has been, honestly, better than their opponent almost every night. They outworked the Jets all four games. They've outworked the Flames all four games. They've outworked the Jets the last two. Over the last seven, they've got the best goal differential in the league if you look at it by expected goals. Just not in fact. And a lot of that issue, like a lot of their problems, what's caused the Canucks to drop these games in which they've looked so good is of their own design, J-Pat. Like, between February 2nd and last night when Brandon Sutter opens the scoring thanks to a fortunate bounce off the stanchion, the Canucks didn't get a 5-on-5 goal from one of their bottom six lines. Like, none of their, no goals, 0-4, 9 against. No. It undoes all the good work from the Lotto line and Nils Höglander and on and on. And I mean, what's resulted is, you know, over the course of these games in which they've played well, like, they're sub .500. They're sub .500, and they deserve better. Like, this is bad luck. They will win more games than they lose if they continue to play like this. But not enough games to get back into it. Because, you know, when I was giving you they need five of the next six, like, they needed five of the next six in order to, from then on, play to a 95 or 98 point pace and make the playoffs. And now, like, they need their next four, and then they need to play at a 107 point pace. Like, they need to play at a 109 point pace from here on out to get to the 63 point barrier and guarantee a playoff spot. 109! Like, you know, the Canucks need to suddenly become the 2018-19 Tampa Bay Lightning. And like, I know they have JT Miller, but that's about it. Like, that's about it. And so, you know, we're not at a point where the season is lost, right? But we're at a point where these losses, where that Jets loss last night isn't like, oh, what a devastating loss, what a catastrophe. It's like, no, the catastrophe happened weeks ago. This barely matters. Like, this barely matters. This is a marginal loss in terms of their overall playoff hopes. What's going to matter isn't what we saw last night. It's, you know, whether or not they can at some point over the next 12 games reel off like 10. Reel off 8 of the next 10 or 10 of the next 12. Like, the losses themselves won't actually harm the Canucks' chances very much going forward here. And the leverage will not ratchet up again unless this team wins a ton. Just like a dizzying amount. Like, goes on 2 weeks between losses. That's what it's going to take for these wins or these losses to matter at all. And, you know, it's just not going to happen. They just don't have the goaltending. They just don't have what they need to be that team this year. And, you know, that has to be disappointing for Canucks fans. And I think it poses a ton of really difficult questions about what's next for this club.
Right. And we can certainly get into that as we move along here. goaltending has been spotty, and I do think there have been a few nights where Travis Green maybe has overthought it or made the wrong call ultimately. And look, it's easy to second guess. I'll readily admit that up front. But Thatcher Demko was good on Friday. It's just that Laurent Boissois was a little bit better and got the shutout. I don't think there was any doubt that the Jets were coming back with Connor Hellebuyck. I think it probably would have been the right call to come back with Thatcher Demko, but Braden Holtby was good in the win in Calgary the other night, so I understand where Travis Green's coming from, but really, for me, like, goaltending hasn't been great. It hasn't been Jacob Markstrom level. We've kind of kicked that issue to death, but I don't think goaltending has sunk the Canucks on a lot of nights. There have been some nights where we've said, oh, they needed a save. They just, volume of goals. They needed a save in there. I thought goaltending sunk them last night. And there were other breakdowns as well. But, man, that Scheifele goal, the Scheifele goal in the third period was brutal.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was the first time this year where you got that, like, bench sags. Like, no.
Totally.
That was the first goal. That was the first example of that. Their goaltending has...
And that's 22 games into the season. Like, totally. That's pretty remarkable that it took that long to have one of those goals that you just went, oh, God, like, the Jets are winning this thing. The Jets are winning it now. There's no way that they're not coming back. And what a crazy night, in as much as that game last night followed the script of last Monday against Calgary, where the Canucks were full value for a really good first period. They got the lead. They extended it. And then the Flames scored three in a row, and the Canucks needed a late goal. They got it. Go to overtime. And it followed the script right down to the fact that, now, Calgary scored on a power play in overtime, but they had four forwards on the ice. The Jets went with their top line. They went with a three-forward set in OT. And I know Brock Besser is not an NHL defenseman, but he has to do a better job of just impeding Pierre-Luc Dubois on the way to the net there. But then they needed a save, too, and Holtby wasn't able to come up with it. So, to have a 2-0 lead and to take a lead to the third period and all those things that are supposed to matter in hockey, and this team, unfortunately, is fragile. Now, they do mount the late goal they were looking for, and what an absolute laser by Elias Pettersson. And
beautiful shot. It's the second time they've done it, right? Like,
yeah.
Are they really fragile, J-Pat, or are they just dreadful?
Well, no, that's why, like, I think there is a fragility to them, but they didn't just roll over and go quietly. Like, they did push and get the goal they were looking for, as I said, not just last night, but the Calgary game as well. But, Tom, they're 22 games in. And, like, they're not good enough sort of on balance. We've made that abundantly clear. So in these games that are coin flips, that are tied late, that go to overtime, like, they've got to find a way to win more than their share. Like, if they're going to keep pace and chip away. And
yeah.
22, they have won. They have 22 games in. They have one of those wins. It was against Montreal, the shootout win, right, where they were down late. They three times this year, they've scored a late goal to tie and get it to overtime. And the only time that they've been able to win one of those coin flip type of games was against Montreal way back when. Otherwise, the moral victory, like, reading Wyatt's Armies, and he pointed it out. Like, he felt like he had written that game about 10 times already this season, where you're trying to find the highlights, the fight. Yeah, the fight. Zach MacEwen beat up forward. Great, I guess. I mean, it doesn't mean anything now, but, you're just left to sort of cherry pick. But Pettersson was special. Like, the between the legs goal was awesome. It was. Like, I wish it meant more for him. I wish it meant more for the hockey club. But that was a cool goal, no doubt about it. And then to see him just, basically at the driving range, like, the crossbar, he hits Hellebuyck in the mask, like, he wasn't going to be denied, essentially, and in the end, none of that matters.
The February 22nd game against Winnipeg, the game we said that Sutter, or that Pettersson would pass Sutter in total goals, right, J-Pat?
And he did again.
Well, and in fact, they jockeyed back and forth. So the power of the VanCast manifesting a real race between two of Vancouver's secondary leading scorers. It wasn't Besser versus Horvat, but it was good fun. And it included a goal. Long snap goal. Like, he basically hutted the puck into the net. I've never seen anything like it. I was racking my brain because I've seen between the legs goals. Like, I've seen all manner of highlights, and I was just like, I don't think I've ever seen that.
Yeah, well, it was like a drop volley at the net. Like, I saw people, making Rafa and Roger Federer kind of, except,
right.
Oh, I mean, you see some tennis guys go between the legs, but it was like a half volley too, like just the hand eye. We know that about him. But again, when you look at sort of crazy things about this season and why they haven't gone according to form, 22 games in, that's the first time that Elias Pettersson has had either multiple goals or multiple assists in the same hockey game. He's had a couple of multi-point games against Ottawa where he had a goal and an assist, but it took him 22 games to have a night where, you know, he had multiple either or, and it turned out that it was goals. So you keep waiting, thinking that something might be the catalyst for him to just really go off and have one of those huge nights. And he's playing way better than he was early in the season, there's no doubt. But again, at the end of the night, they're coming up a goal short, and they're just not good enough unless they basically play the perfect game. And I'm not sure that this group, that this team, has the perfect game in them. But you're right. The Sutter versus Pettersson thing, it at least provided some levity for us along press row last night, because for a short while, Brandon Sutter had, in fact, pulled in front of Elias Pettersson when Sutter scored. And that was actually a cool goal, too. Sutter never turned his hand over after the faceoff win. He beats Lowry cleanly on the draw. The Ben shot goes wide, bounces off the end boards. Sutter still got his hand turned over, and then he went like mini stick. He like rode the other hand like up the stick and sort of bunted the puck in. And at that moment, Sutter had six and Pettersson was stuck on five. And so we were like, all right, Brandon Sutter's back in front of Elias Pettersson. Pettersson had something to say about that, though. He ends up with two. So Petey's back in front now, 7-6. Unfortunately, the fact that we are charting Elias, as you said, it's not Besser and Horvat. It's Elias Pettersson and Brandon Sutter. And that's the derby that has us invested right now.
I mean, look, you find your fun where you can, right?
You're right. No, you are right.
I liked Harmon Dial, who was on the other side of the pole. Usually there's like a post in the press box and we're all socially distanced and in masks and well away from one another, but usually we're a little bit closer to Harmon and are able to chat with him. And Harmon walks to the other side of the post and still a safe social distance away from us, just sort of eyes downtrodden. He goes, "This team's awful." You and I just crack up. That was midway through the third period last night.
Right.
I mean, look, it was funny. Harmon's delivery was spot on, and, you know, him grappling with the reality, this team just has no margin for error, right? Like, there's just no margin for error, and that's been true. Like, that was true last season, right? Like, that's the thing. That was true last season. It's just that the Canucks had an elite goaltender. Like, Markstrom was a core piece, and his absence is felt. You know, one thing we said all offseason, J-Pat, was like, the absence of Markstrom, like this has, Vancouver has not made a big enough, the Vancouver market does not understand how big a departure this is. You know what I mean? And now we're watching these games and it feels like after the season in which, you know, they swept the Blues and lost in six to the Blackhawks, like, which was the season in which Luongo was a free agent, right? Like imagine Luongo had left, right? Like that's basically what happened to this Canucks team. And it's evident, like there's no margin for error. There wasn't any last year, but at least they had a goaltender. Like at least they had an elite, elite goaltender. Demko and Holtby are below expected in terms of, you know, goals saved, like above average. Like the goals that they've saved, they're below expected goals in terms of what Vancouver's defense is giving up. So, you know, we all know that the Canucks don't create an easy environment for their goaltenders, but even accounting for that, like the goaltending's been part of the goal prevention problem for the Canucks all season. That goal prevention problem's honestly mostly solved, and they just haven't picked up wins quickly enough here. And now, you know, they're just looking at a situation where they have to be completely bonkers, like so good to make the playoffs the rest of the way. And, you know, I do think there's two things now that come out of that. One, that begins to pivot us, like begins to shine a spotlight on the trade deadline, right? Because there's no help coming. Like the Canucks have played the type of stretch in terms of the effort level, in terms of how the players have responded, that in a normal world, you might consider like getting them some reinforcements, bringing in the cavalry, making an in-season trade to like shake things up, and reward your group, frankly, right? That can't happen. Like, if the Canucks were to acquire a guy from playing on an American-based team, like, he's not debuting until game 30, like past the halfway mark of the season. That's like 8 games from now. And that's if everything went well in terms of work visas and on and on. Like, it's just not practical. Even from a Canadian team, like, the guy's not debuting until the first week of March, right? It's the club's already thin. Playoff hopes could be over, like extinguished by then. So you can't really do that. But if you're selling too, like, man, you have to be proactive here. Like, you have to be working on that now. And you've got some, you know, depth guys, like the types of guys that teams often really like to acquire before a playoff run, who are playing really well, you know, playing above their level. Jordy Benn and Brandon Sutter in particular, right? Obviously, Tanner Pearson, cup pedigree, top six forward. Like, there's a lot to like there in terms of, you know, his profile as a trade deadline asset. Like, the Canucks need to probably start pivoting into that, because we're only, today's 8 weeks out from the NHL trade deadline, and a lot of teams are looking at a week delay. If you trade a guy now, at least he's going to have a chance to get really familiar. Like, he's going to get to play the 20 games with his new team, maybe 30 games that you usually get to play if you're dealt at the deadline. You're going to get to practice regularly. Like, if you make that deal on April 12th, teams are going to have like 10 games left. You know, the quarantine protocols on and on, like, plays in 10-ish games for his new team. Maybe gets a practice in before the playoffs. Like, you're really going to pay your best price for a rental then? Or are you going to do it a little earlier? Like, I think you need to be proactive on this. And the other thing this does shine a spotlight on, J-Pat, is with the effort that this team is putting in on a night-to-night basis as the light dims on their season. Like, man, that reflects well on the club's unsigned, unextended head coach, right? Like, that's another thing here is, for all that's gone wrong for the Canucks this season, one of the few things that hasn't, regardless of what we're going to say about, you know, a goaltending decision, and, you know, it's not like there's a clear starter here, right? Like, it's not like this is how the Flames have completely screwed up their usage of David Rittich and Jacob Markstrom, right? Like, the Holtby over Demko was surprising, but a reasonable decision, all
totally.
Things considered.
Yep, yep.
One of the things that has definitely not gone wrong for the Canucks this season has been the coaching. Like, they've kept problem solving. They've kept grinding. They've kept trying things. You know, and they've problem solved effectively. Like, structurally, they found ways to stem the defensive bleeding. Like, they have worked through this in a clever way. They've done, you know, more than you'd expect. And most importantly, they haven't done that, ooh, we'll just play what we've given. You know, they haven't started building their resume for their next job interview, you know? A pitch which begins with, we did our best with bad personnel. And they'd be well within their rights to do so. Like, 9 out of 10 NHL coaching staffs are already in that mode in a similar circumstance. That reflects really well on the Canucks' head coach. Flex well on his assistants. Flex well on his goalie coach. None of them have contracts next year. And the club's recent run of form, like, shines a spotlight on that, right? It really emphasizes that one of the things that this club has going for it, in fact, is kind of out there. Like, it's out there in the ether, at risk of, you know, joining a division rival at the tail end of the season. And as we get closer to that date, by the way, the incentives change, and Green's sort of likelihood to prioritize security and stay put diminishes too. Like, that's kind of how free agency works. Like, that's how player extensions work. We saw it with Markstrom, and we might see it with Green again, which just sort of adds to the stakes and the disappointment and sort of the need for this club to begin to be like, there's too much at stake here for this team to continue to like waste time. They need to chart a deliberate course here, make a plan, stick to it, and go about executing it here. It's not, you know, about calling for anyone's head or regime change. It's like, it's just looking at the priorities and seeing that this, like, there's no waiting for the dust to settle. There's no limping through the season and then figuring it out. Like, what this club is facing in terms of the deadline, in terms of Green, in terms of, you know, the expansion draft, in terms of Pettersson and Hughes' next contracts, like, these are moments that are going to shape the next 5-6 years of this franchise. Like, the next 8 months might dictate whether this club ever wins a Stanley Cup with this high-end core group that they've assembled. And you can't be sitting on your hands here, you know, sort of counting shekels through the end of the season. Like, a plan needs to be put in place. Whether it's Benning or the next guy, like, it's unfair for the approach to be wait and see right now. Like, that's just not exciting. It's intolerable. A cardinal sin. That's sort of where we're at with the Canucks season.
And there isn't a single person, Tom, that would have watched these last five Canuck games and said, absolutely, like, they have tightened things up. They look different than they did in that run through Montreal and Toronto. And look, Montreal was playing well then. They're not right now. Toronto, we know what they're doing. Auston Matthews is basically unstoppable. So, you know, the opponents were better 2 weeks ago than they are right now. I mean, Calgary was scuffling along, and Winnipeg looked beatable. It's just the Canucks didn't get the job done. But whatever the case, the last five games, there's no doubt. I mean, there's structure there. I do think that the Lotto line is playing better, although it is still, you know, on a nightly basis, there are defensive breakdowns with those guys that seem to wind up in the back of the net. But, it, you know, it's funny. I've seen people that have tried to put the positive spin on, like, you know, since the owner came off the top rope with the tweet thread, you know, they picked up points in four or five. And that is true. They have picked up points in four or five. They've also won two of those five. So, you know, did the owner's tweet thread really, you know, turn the season around? Did Derek Forbert, going after Nils Höglander, turn the season? No, none of that stuff. But to your point about Travis Green, like, I still believe, and look, we had a great conversation with Ray last time on the podcast, and it was terrific to get him on, and lots of great feedback, people missing hearing Ray in the market, so it was good. But we talked a little bit about Travis Green and his security, and, you know, for all those points that you make about the job that he and his staff are doing, like, I still think that if the Canucks, if ownership truly believes that Travis Green is the guy for this group now and moving forward, I do think there are ways that you could lower the temperature that go way beyond, you know, just sitting at your phone and tweeting out, we're not going to panic and you know, I'm not looking to make changes now. You know, structure a deal so that, you know, maybe next year is flat for Travis Green, but then, you know, there are ways to, I think we've discussed this on previous podcasts, but, you know, I do think you could, if the coach is coaching and it looks like he's doing his job, even if they're not getting results, and I guess that's open for interpretation, if they're not getting results, is the coach ultimately doing his job? I still think there is a way that this ownership group could structure a contract to give Travis Green some security, because, as you point out, the closer we get to the end of the season, he's going to have options. I'm sure he's looking around, and I have said this before on this podcast and on the radio as well, until the Seattle Kraken have a head coach, or until Travis Green puts his name to paper, like, that storyline is going to exist. It is. And so I don't get it. I do understand we're in a pandemic and there, you know, revenue isn't what it once was for the Vancouver Canucks, but the Aquilinis aren't going poor. I do think there's a way that they could extend Travis Green if they wanted to, but it does then beg the question of, as you said, like, if they make a management change, and we still, you know, we see it in sports all the time that a new GM comes in and wants to survey the situation and maybe has his eye on his own guy, and then, you know, the change comes from the top down. So all of this, I think, is on the table right now because we seem to just be in this holding pattern that the Canuck organization is prepared to sort of let this slide until the end of the year, and then that becomes a game of chicken with the head coach, who at that point is likely to have some options elsewhere.
Yeah, and just letting it slide, like, just, it hasn't worked for this club. And so, sure, you let it slide with Green. Are you going to let it slide with Hughes and Pettersson? Because those are all also guys who are up. Those are pretty important contracts. I think you probably need to be working on those. Are you going to let it slide in terms of expansion? Because, you know, one of the things about Adam Gaudette and Jake Virtanen not performing to expectations this year, while it's hurt the club's offensive depth significantly, and the second power play unit, it also has created an environment where outside of Miller, Horvat, Besser, Pettersson, you're not really losing sleep over exposing anyone else in the expansion draft. Like, you're probably at the point where you're protecting Tyler Mott and, you know, maybe Cole Lind.
Yeah,
which means you have another slot. Like, you can acquire another forward from a team that's got protection issues now. You know what I'm saying? Like, relatively affordably, potentially. You need to be proactive on exploring that. Like, that's crucial. I've been talking about the defense forever, but now you probably open up front too. Like, that's, you could do better than Seattle and with a plan and with some gumption here. This club just can't afford to wait and see on any of these things at this point. Like, there needs to be, at the very least, a plan being put in place. Because if you bring a guy in a month before this all unfolds, like, after you've sold at, or, you know, at the deadline, like, I mean, they're just not walking into a good situation. And if this management group is your management group, and, you know, I don't see a lot of signs that that's the case, right? Like, despite the Twitter thread, but if this is your management group, like, a green extension would also have the benefit of signaling the stability that you claimed in public in a meaningful way, right? Like, you want to settle this market down? That would do it. Like, that would do it pretty quick. But it's not fair. It's not fair to anybody. Like, it's not fair to the current group. It's not fair to anyone that comes in next, for them to only have like 4 weeks before the expansion draft to fix this all, right? Or to be starting in the off season on material extension talks with Hughes and Pettersson, or to have a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the league year ends to negotiate with Green, you know, or to even make the determination whether they want him or the next guy, you know, like, it's just, yep. There, whether it's the current man, whether there's regime change is almost immaterial to what I'm discussing. It's about how the organization's going to approach some really high leverage issues here. Because there's just not time to chill and sit about. Like, there's just not. There's too much going on with this team, too much that's important, too much uncertainty amidst the pandemic, too big a challenges for whoever's next, including whether or not that's Jim or not. And yet, I think we all think that the plan, like, their ideal plan is to sit and wait. It just should not be acceptable, man. Like, that is a way bigger deal than the wins and losses.
And on the trade deadline front, like, you think how quickly the Canucks have arrived at 22 games, right? Like, they played more games than anybody, but the training camp felt like it was yesterday or the day before. Like, they've arrived at 22 games. They're 22 games away from the trade deadline. So it's going to get here in a hurry. And I'm with you. Like, I just think with all of the COVID issues, I think this will be a different trade deadline. I think it'll be a muted trade deadline. I don't expect that. Agreed. We'll see the activity. So that just ups the stakes now for a management group, if they've got players that they feel have some market value, to get proactive and to try to drive business. Because the longer you wait, and if teams identify needs elsewhere, then you scratch that team off the list as a potential trade partner because they've met their needs. So get out in front of it here. Like, be the drivers and be aggressive. And that's just not something that we have seen from this current management group. And so I think that, you know, there's sort of a, you know, people wouldn't believe it until they saw it, right? It was sort of like weaponizing cap space. The entire market talked for years about weaponizing cap space, and it just wasn't a mechanism that this management group wanted to take advantage of. And we've been through trade deadlines with Hamhuis and Verbata where nothing happened. And Dan Hamhuis went on to play 5 more years of reasonable hockey. Like, there was value in Dan Hamhuis.
Yeah.
And nothing happened then. And
he would have still been a top 4 Canucks defenseman for most of those seasons.
Right.
And like, until Quinn Hughes came into the league. Like, until last season, Dan Hamhuis would have been Vancouver's second best left-handed defenseman.
Right. Start a marketing campaign for the guys that you've got. Get out in front of other teams that are going to also want to offload and make some of these moves. And again, we'll see if it happens. I know that, you know, there was the one deadline with Burrows and Hansen, but beyond that, we haven't seen this group sort of be proactive on a lot of levels. And so this will be interesting. But I think you and I are on the same page in that regard, and that this trade deadline is going to get here a lot faster than people recognize in a shortened season. Again, April 12th. Is the trade deadline.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, what did you make of reverse retros? They're winless in them, but I thought at the rink, honestly, like, and I'm not a huge jersey guy, but I thought they popped. I actually liked the look of reverse retro.
Me too. They look good. The navy is the key. Like, I don't love the gradient. What I love is the way that the green pops off of the navy. From well above the ice level at Rogers Arena, those jerseys look sick. And I do think the Canucks can do a lot more with navy. I think that was, I suspect that was part of why they introduced it here. Why they used the reverse retros the way they did. Now, I do want to note, too, as I recall, the gradient was bad luck last time, too. The red gradient during the, you know, latter stages of the West Coast Express era, I don't think they ever won in those. Like, that was, like, a thing the players started to grumble about, and so on and so forth. Like, they didn't like those jerseys because they thought they were bad luck. You know, that was one of the reasons that I sort of raised my eyebrows that they reappropriated them. But yeah, winless in the gradient is actually paying tribute to the gradient's rich history for this organization.
Well, they get another chance. This is the reverse retro homestand, and so now they got to try to slow down McDavid in reverse retro. That's not going to be an easy chore, and we've seen that already this season, the way that he had the big night, night two of the year when he had the hat trick in Edmonton. But it's always fun to see Connor McDavid come to town. I don't know if it's much fun to play against him, but the challenge remains for the Canucks. They've got to try to find a way to slow him down, and Leon Draisaitl as well. Hey, I wanted to ask you, too, about, like, I don't know, like, I've been around, I've seen some things, I suppose. I was there the night that McSorley whacked Donald Brashear. I was there at the rink the night that Bertuzzi clubbed Steve Moore. Like, I couldn't get over the reaction to a scrum on Friday night. Like, Canucks Twitter was losing its shit over a scrum. Like, and like, look, Forbert should have got a cross-checking penalty. Like, there should have been a cross-check in there somewhere that should have been called, and the Canucks might have got a power play, you know, with a 1-0 deficit with 5 to go, and maybe that changes the game. They didn't get the call there. I heard Forbert's quotes. I'm not sure why he was so upset. And yeah, like, good for the Canucks. Like, I'm glad that they jumped in and stuck up for Hoglander. They bloody well should have. But that seems so tame to me. Like, that used to happen 3 times a game not that long ago. And I couldn't get over the reaction. It was like people had never seen a dog pile in the National Hockey League.
It was, yeah, I mean, it's a sign of the times, right? Like, that's where the game
sure
is
at. Sure it is. Yeah.
And, you know, so it goes. I mean, I don't mind it personally. Like, I don't mind it. I just think what you need fundamentally is not to be like it's like the league is gone and we've now got the worst version possible of how the game is called, right? Where, like, you still have the post whistle stuff to some extent, but it's not as entertaining or barbaric or, like, doesn't quench the same sort of itch for blood sport. Like, doesn't scratch that itch at all. That it used to, and yet you still don't really have an environment where the game is called in a way that would favor a player like Nils Höglander over a player like Derek Forbert, or would favor a player like Elias Pettersson over X grinder, you know, who's going to get away with XYZ, Matt Greslick, whatever. So the league's still not doing really enough to protect their stars from a entertainment perspective, but doesn't really have the same level of, like, you know, gladiator, post whistle, on ice fights, settle the score, code stuff. Otherwise, so you've kind of got the worst of both worlds at the moment, and that's just very classic NHL, right? Like, fighting has sort of been legislated out with, you know, the instigator penalty and mandatory visors and on, and you know, refs honestly told to do everything they can to break up fights, but you still haven't created an environment that really favors skilled players or pushes the envelope in that respect, or rewards teams tactically that really do play a more entertaining style. And for me, that's what's most regrettable. Like, I understand why the league has changed its priorities on fighting, on a variety of things. What I don't understand is why that hasn't come, you know, hat in hand with the types of, you know, innovations in terms of how the game is called that would benefit the players that are the most marketable and the most entertaining to watch, you know, in line with how every other league has operated over 25 years, whether it's the NBA with the hand check rule or how the NFL, you know, protects quarterbacks to, you know, make sure that the product itself is as entertaining and thrilling as humanly possible. But that's sort of where we're at. So that's my view of it. I know that's a very grumpy old man answer here, but that's,
I thought I was the grumpy old
usually
man on the podcast.
Usually you are.
And look, I don't miss the after the whistle scrum at the net front. Like, I think that's good that stuff has gone away, but hockey, when it's at its best, is speed and skill, but in this arena where, you know, you're always on the edge that you could absolutely, you know, have your head taken off, essentially. Like, maybe not. That's okay. That's a little extreme. But there's always that threat that, you know, there's a price to pay. And that's what makes the game we love. And so, like, I had no problem with, you know, the Canucks stuck up for their young rookie who, you know, they should. Like, that, I think that maybe there needed to be a few more moments along the way where we saw some of that kind of stuff. And, you know, Travis Green afterwards, I thought, you know, he didn't seem to want to get into it too much other than to say it was a big guy picking on a little guy. You know, Hoglander is probably the shortest Canuck, but he's not the lightest. Like, in fact, I went and looked. I think there are five guys that are listed at a lower weight than Nils Hoglander. My sense is that Hoglander hasn't probably been involved in a lot of that, but if he continues to play the way that he does and has, he's going to get the attention of others, and that's what makes him effective. And so, you know, I'm not sure I'd want to be at the bottom of a pile with that many guys, you know, jumping all over me, but that comes with the territory. And again, it's so out of the norm for what we see from night to night that it seemed to take on a life of its own. I got a kick on Saturday, sort of in the aftermath. People just wouldn't let it go because there was this big wild scrum that lasted about 25 seconds. And somehow it was like the craziest thing that anybody had seen in the National Hockey League in years. So I like the game when it's got a little heat to it.
Me too. And I liked his Nils Hoglander's reaction to the McEwen fight, right? Look, the McEwen fight, the way that he, I mean, McEwen's and that was like an old school game for McEwen, right? Like, that was like an out of the 90s. He has two shifts in the first period, and one of them includes, you know, like smacking the home white color off an opponent, right? Like, I mean, that's classic. That's great. And, you know, it's great, but we also look at it a little differently now, and so it goes. But but I love it. I can't help it. Like, I love that. Just as a guy who enjoys hockey and grew up watching a specific type of game, like, I'm a bit of a troglodyte when it comes to that. What did you think, by the way, post-game? I noted Travis Green being like, well, that's the code. That was actually the other day, right? He was like, yeah, that's the great thing about hockey. Hockey's got a code. Green's been made out to be perhaps more of a, like, progressive anti-fighting type coach than I think probably matches that type of comment, right? So I thought that was an interesting one. It certainly had my eyebrows raised.
Yeah. Yeah, he came through his playing days in an era where every team was stocked with tough guys. So it's part of the game. It's always going to be. And quite frankly, you know, look, Zach McEwen did his part last night. Like it, not whatever. That is an element that Zach McEwen brings to the game. He's not going to do it every game. But it's probably time to give Zach McEwen a little bit of runway here and just let him play. Like, on Friday night, in a 1-0 game, Louis and Jay Beagle saw one shift over the final 29 minutes, right? And they're not going to bring offense. I get that. But still, there's two of your 12 forwards that you don't feel you can play or don't want to play over the second half of a hockey game. Like, I think, you know, the Lotto line played close to 10 minutes of the third period on Friday night. And I saw JT Miller played 11 and a half in the third period last night, because there were special teams both ways.
Yeah.
And so his ice time's getting up to a point that, and Travis Green addressed that at some point here over the last week, that, you know, he recognizes that Miller's ice time is getting a little high even for him. I mean, you get to a point of diminishing returns when you're asking a guy to play 11 and a half minutes of the third period, especially when you're down and now you're pressing for the equalizer. But, you know, again, Louis came in, had his five games, I think it was. He got his empty net assist. But I'm fine if we don't see Louis for a while yet. And it's probably just time to give McEwen a little bit of a run. And the other thing, too, is, you know, last night they took a lead to the third period. And I tweeted out after 40 that it was going to be interesting to see deployment. You know, Jake didn't see a third period shift. Jake did not play in the third period last night. And that's when they had a lead. They were tied and then they were down. And Jake Virtanen didn't get off the bench in the third period. And Olielewi, we haven't talked about Olielewi, but there seems to be a lot of noise out there, too, in Canuck Twitter that, you know, people are seeing great progressions with Olielewi. I think Olielewi had one shift in the final 15 minutes of last night's game. So keep in mind what you're watching with Olielewi right now, too. These are all home games where, you know, they can protect him and shelter him. They get the last change in the deployment. There have been some moments. Like, he had a decent defensive play on Nick Ehlers last night, but on Friday, Nick Ehlers absolutely torched him with the old inside-out move. And so it's still, I think, very much a work in progress for Olielewi, but I'm a little surprised. I think people want to believe the idea of Olielewi, but I'm not sure that the reality matches sort of what some people are seeing in this guy right now.
Well, I mean, look, he's playing in the NHL and he doesn't look out of place in a depth role. And, you know, he's on an entry-level contract. There's real value there. It's not the type of value you are going for usually when you pick in the top five of the NHL draft. But, you know, there's real value there. And with very much limited offensive profile and a very much limited track record in the NHL, Olielewi projects to potentially be affordable depth defensive labor for years to come. And there are tangible benefits to that. Like, there, that matters for this club, especially as Pettersson and Hughes get expensive. But let's not go overboard here, right? Like, this is a guy who's played extremely prescribed minutes. You know, he's been sheltered. That's sort of, like, he's been sheltered less, actually, of late. And wasn't sheltered much until the game was sort of really tight last night. But he's also got one goal, right? Like, he's got one goal. It was a fortunate goal in 14 games. Like, usually when you shelter a guy on a third pair, you're looking for significant special teams contributions or offense. And Olielewi's not really providing that, which, you know, is a little bit eyebrow raising. That said, he's played well. He's gone through a lot. It's, you know, good to see a good kid having made the show and performing decently well. But, you know, the idea that this is a real bright spot, like, just doesn't match. Like, I just don't know that Olielewi is playing on 28 other teams' blue lines. And frankly, you know, I don't know that he's among Vancouver's six best. When Hamonic comes back, the Canucks only have one right-handed shot in the lineup right now. It's Tyler Myers. Tyler Myers is leading all Canucks and even strength ice time, probably because of the handedness thing, right? Are they going to keep Olielewi in, or are they going to bring in a guy who can help the PK? Not that the PK needs help right now, but, I suspect they'll probably figure out a way to get Hamonic into the lineup, right? Like, I suspect your third pair then becomes Edler Myers, right? And you're potentially able to, you know, really manage Edler's minutes more, though. I mean, does that even matter if the team's this far out of it? I suppose we'll see, but I just don't see the excitement. Like, we can't, you know what? It's like Vancouver has forgotten what, you know, a promising defense prospect looks like. Like, it's either Hughes or everyone is Hughes. You know, like we've seen so many super rookies come in, right? That every young player is worth getting excited about. But, like, this, we haven't seen a lot of, like, depth players come in. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen Zach McEwen, I guess, but he's kind of been touch and go. We've seen Adam Gaudette, but even Adam Gaudette was, like, scoring like crazy. You know what I'm saying? Like, they've all been offensive profile guys. Olielewi to me looks like, you know, a depth guy. Like, he looks like a depth guy, an NHL depth guy. And he'll probably have an NHL career, and hopefully for him it's successful. Like, I'm not rooting against the kid by any means. I just don't see a lot there. Like, I just don't see a lot in terms of pace, in terms of how he defends in space, in terms of usage. Like, I just don't see a lot to get excited about beyond, his contract status and the fact that he's likely to be affordable depth labor for several years to come, and you know, during seasons in which the Canucks are really going to need pieces like that. So that's good, but it's good to a point, right? Like, that's good. It's just not, you know, well, that's the one bright spot on the blue line. It's like, no, no, it's a depth piece. What are we talking about? Like, what are we talking about? You know what? Here's the last thing. I just didn't think he was that good against when, like, I didn't think the Yolevi Myers, I thought the Yolevi Myers pair for most of the night was Vancouver's worst against Winnipeg on Sunday. And it just did not, what I was watching on the ice did not at all match the tenor of what I was reading on my timeline.
Right. I think that's the point that I was sort of getting at in a roundabout way, but you filled it in succinctly there. And so let's see. Like, you know, we talked about McDavid. Like, hopefully, Olli Levy doesn't have to see a whole lot of Connor McDavid here. The Canucks can, you know, work the matchups. But we saw in Toronto sort of the demise of Jalen Chatfield, where the Leafs jumped the Canucks every time that Chatfield was on the ice, and it didn't go so well, particularly the Saturday night game. And we haven't seen Jalen Chatfield since. So let's see how this thing goes. The challenges are only going to get steeper from here for Olli Juolevi.
Well, there is one steak that's only available by special request. We call it sirloin a lot. It's the size of a boogie board.
Ooh, I'll have that one. And a drink? Meatballs.
Very good, sir.
All right, we'll finish up, as we always do, with a quick check of our grand wager, the stake bet, the high-stakes bet on the season when they got shut out on Friday. Obviously, no change there. Petey with his two goals. When we look at Elias Pettersson, you know, we both anticipated that he was going to be in the low 20s on the season. He's got some work to do, but a few more two-goal games along the way certainly might change his trajectory, I suppose. I had Pettersson with 23 goals. You have him at 22, so right now you've got the inside track there. But Brandon Sutter...
Oh.
I had Sutter for 8. You had him at 7. He's sitting at 6 now. So,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah, but, now, but again, this could be Schaller bet territory.
Well, and we should probably lay out the ground rules. I don't know if we have to do it here on the podcast. Right, but he could also score some goals for another team at the end of the season.
That's true. No. Those count. I remember we litigated this when Schaller got dealt, and I was like, no, Schaller scores for the Kings, those still count. So, like, because of that, because of the Schaller precedent.
Okay.
Yeah. It's his season totals, regardless of where he plays them.
I like the fact that we have the Schaller precedent. I just think that sounds...
Yeah. The Schaller precedent, which is, because of Durant's desperation, goals scored for another team do in fact count. That's the Schaller precedent.
I'm just envisioning, you know, those law offices, like with all the books on the shelf, and like somewhere deep in one of those books, we could get a lawyer to go and open it up to find the Schaller precedent that well, exists in print somewhere.
Well, it reminds me of when I used to write about, like, there was a 18-month stretch when I was at Canucks Army, like when I was really young in the industry, where twice a week I wrote about the Luongo trade, right? Like, twice a week for 18 months, as Luongo did not get traded, I wrote about, you know, things that examined the framework of the deal. And in the course of doing so, like, I kind of got bored, right? Like, I was just like, this is boring. Like, the latest rumor, Luongo for Bjugstad, right? Like, I'd be unpacking it. And so along the way, I devised something, and I called it the Scott Gomez, or I called it the Gomez Corollary. And the Gomez Corollary is that all contracts, no matter how bad, are in fact tradable. That's the Gomez corollary. So now we've got the Schaller precedent as well. And, you know, we can keep building up our portfolio of, like, fake hockey legalese as we go here,
right,
J-Pat.
Okay.
We're going to have a lot. We're going to have a lot of things to unpack, and probably not a ton of stakes here. And especially if, well, sorry, we'll have stakes at the end of the season, but not stakes with the AKES. Potentially, yes, for this Canucks season, because it is late, even though it's early.
Right, and on the last podcast, I bitched because Sutter had scored an empty netter, and I thought that kind of contravened the rules, but last night there was a goalie. He scored, so yes, Brandon Sutter won that side wager. I'm still not gainfully employed. Really, in hindsight, I should have been smart enough, though. My little bet with Sutter should have been, you know, who gets... does he get an assist before I get a job? That is probably a fairer, better wager, because Sutter sitting on 6 points, all goals, all at home, by the way, after his little bunt job last night on Connor Hellebuck. Hey, just as we wrap things up, I should mention that Keith Tkachuk is coming up as the guest on the Athletic Hockey Show with Ian Mendez and Haley Salvian. You might want to check that out. This is the week that the Tkachuk boys go head-to-head on the ice, the Flames in Ottawa later this week. So Matthew and Brady can renew their rivalry there. And Dad Keith is checking in on the Athletic Hockey Show. And as we always say as we wrap things up, check out our comments section for each podcast episode at the Athletic app. Rate and subscribe to the VanCast on Apple. And if you're not already a subscriber, go to theathletic.com/VanCast. Receive a subscription for just $3.99 a month. Again, huge thanks to Ray Ferraro for stepping in and joining us on the last VanCast.
Ton of fun.
Terrific to visit with him. And yeah, we'll hopefully make that happen again. We've got our eyes on a few other guests here in the near future as well. So stick with us as we continue to chart progress of this Vancouver Canucks hockey team. 22 games in, coming off the overtime loss to the Winnipeg Jets 4-3 on Sunday night. For Drancer, it's J-Pat. As always, thanks so much for listening to another edition of the VanCast here at The Athletic and theathletic.com.